Hey guys, this is Adam Rippon.
Hey, this is Michael White.
Hey guys, it's Christy Amaguchi.
Hi, and I'm Maya Shibutani.
And I'm Alex Shibutani.
Hi, I'm Brian Orser.
Hi, this is Megan Duhamel.
And I'm Eric Radford.
I'm Madison Chalk.
And I'm Evan Bates.
Hey guys, this is Nathan Chen, U.S. champion.
Hi, this is Brian Boitano, and you're listening to Ice Talk.
Hey everyone, it is Nick McCarville, and it's episode 33 of Ice Talk, the figure skating podcast from Ice Network. We officially are on our summer schedule, which means we'll be recording episodes every other week with a few exceptions. But this week, we have a gold medal winner. First, it's Brian Boitano, the 1988 Olympic champion. And then we've got another Olympic champ, Merrill Davis. Sit back and relax. And first, let's hear from Mr. Boitano. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Good to be with
you. You were telling me before we went live, you're at home in San Francisco, but you're getting ready to go on a pretty big trip this summer. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to go to Italy this summer. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's kind of happening. There's a lot happening for us because we're renovating the house in San Francisco and a pretty darn big one. And at the same time, going to head over to Italy, and I'm looking for another property to renovate over there. So that should be fun.
That's just a small project, renovating a property in Italy.
You know what? It's actually not as bad as people. I don't know if you ever saw the show that I did where I renovated my great-great-grandfather's house. It was on HGTV, but it was a lot simpler than most people think. And it was only because I found this incredible contractor in the village, and he was incredible, great workmanship, like real artisan, and he just did a fantastic job on the house. So if I didn't have him over there, I wouldn't be considering getting another property.
Awesome. Good. Well, you've found your guy. Brian, we're going to kind of hopscotch around topic-wise, but let's start with skating itself. And talk to me a little bit about what you pulled from this season. Obviously, a lot of people, especially in the States, their eyes on Nathan Chen and what he did for the American men on both the domestic stage as well as internationally. And then I think a lot of people, you know, excited about what Yuzuru Hanyu was able to do, pulling off his win at the World Championships as we head into the Olympic season.
Man, those guys are really, it was so exciting to watch them this year and to actually be in the audience and witness Nathan, you know, having that performance at the U.S. Nationals. It's just so inspiring, and it's a good feeling to be able to watch U.S. figure skating going in that direction. You know, he's definitely going to be a player, and it's been a while since we've had a real serious player that's cutting edge and like literally setting new standards, and it's exactly what we need as figure skating, the sport of figure skating.
Brian, I mean, you were certainly known as a jumper, especially in the early part of your career. So is there some correlation? We talk about Nathan needing to, he's obviously working on those quads as he does, but, you know, he's got to then sort of up the ante on the artistry front. Does it feel at all like sort of your path as well?
Yeah, you know, there are some similarities between he and I. He's definitely... I think that he's really good artistic-wise as well. I mean, especially for his age. I mean, he's so young. I mean, the key for him now is really to focus on the jumping and get those so that he'll never miss them in competition, which he's, you know, going in that direction. Hope that he doesn't grow anymore. And the artistic side will come with being mature, and he's certainly... notices that he needs to improve in that direction, and he's trying to improve in that direction. And the most important thing is that he's capable of moving in those really nice, you know, a nice fashion. So that's the key. If people don't move well and they look sort of mechanical, I think it's a bigger problem than people who move so well as Nathan does. So I don't see it being a problem at all for him, really.
And Brian, have you gotten to know Nathan, or do you guys have any sort of relationship as he's sort of, you know, come into this sort of torchbearer for the U.S. men these last few months?
Yeah, actually, I've done a couple shows with him. I've skated in a couple of Michael Weiss's shows with him. And it was funny because when he first came onto the scene in Novice, Christy Amaguchi and I were watching the exhibitions at Nationals one year, and he came on and did his Kung Fu Panda number.
Yeah.
And And I were like, we need to go back and meet this kid because we absolutely adore him. And so we went backstage and he was, you know, he's not much different now than he was then. He's, you know, shy and kind of doesn't say, you know, he says a few words. And Christy and I were just like, you know, kind of fawning all over him, going like, oh my God, you're so great. I mean, we love you. That was so great. And he was just, you know, he was cute then and he's cute now. So, you know, I think that he's definitely, I mean, I can see an intensity in him that is just, wow, it's just razor sharp intensity. And I think that'll serve him well if he can allow himself to sometimes not be intense. And that's the hard, I was intense, so I know what that's like. To always be intense 100% is tough. So you need to allow yourself a little bit of a breather in between.
Next season, the U.S. Nationals, the U.S. Championships will head to San Jose, to an arena that I think you're familiar with. But tell me about your role for that National Championships, because it'll serve as obviously the last big stage that we'll see the U.S. skaters and help formulate the U.S. Olympic teams before Pyeongchang.
I think it's going to be a really exciting competition, and I think it's great that it's in San Jose, because having Olympic trials in San Jose, it's a skating city. They know what they're seeing. They're educated. They've supported skating. I believe it'll be great crowds because there have been so many champions that came from this area. They're very supportive. So it's a perfect place to do Olympic trials. And yeah, I've been involved in cross-promoting and trying to promote the event. So I just had a meeting last week with San Jose at the arena, and I'm going to do similar to a lot of the stuff that I did for Kansas City, a lot of food, food cross promotion, you know, whether it's, you know, Christmas cookie competitions or cooking demos or doing food classes with, you know, the fans who want to come out and watch the championships, or a cocktail hour, teaching them how to do mixology and mix their own cocktails. So I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to be doing now, but there will be a lot of events before and around the championship that I'm talking about doing, including even maybe a pop-up restaurant in the venue.
Wow. It sounds like you have a tough role. Food, restaurants, and drinks for nationals. I love that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Back in the day when you had to compete, I would have never thought that I was doing this.
No, it's great. I'll be finding you for hopefully a martini during one of those competition nights.
I can handle a martini. That's an easy one.
Brian, how much skating are you still doing these days?
You know, up until December, I was doing a lot of skating because I had, I think I did TV shows last year, and I did a show in Niagara Falls for a week at a casino. But, you know, right in the season when I was doing Scott Hamilton's show, I had a knee injury, and it's a cartilage injury, and I had a real turn for the worse. So I just kind of pushed through the year, kind of stayed off. And so I haven't been skating a lot, but I've been doing compulsory figures because I'm not, you know, because I can't really jump right now. So I've been actually going on and doing an hour and 45 minutes a day of compulsory figures three times a week. So about a week and a half ago, I had stem cells shot into my knee in hopes that it'll grow some cartilage back. And it seems to be very good. I'm just going a little stir crazy because I can't work out at all except small physical therapy things to get the stem cells, you know, activated and, you know, not destroy any new tissue that,
right,
that they're actually. So I'm excited about the prospect of getting back to skating when I return from Italy.
And is there a rink right there in San Francisco that you can actually skate at?
Yeah, I have great Yerba Buena Gardens. It's probably, I mean, everybody that comes, you know, I've had a lot of the skaters, the current skaters come here and they love skating here. It's like a wall of glass and it overlooks the city, like the skyscrapers and
wow,
stuff. And it's
awesome.
Gorgeous. I have ice time there in the mornings on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Fridays, and sometimes Wednesdays. So I have private ice there, and, you know, that's always really wonderful to be able to just have that time alone and kind of do your thing.
Yeah, very cool. Well, I want to transition a little bit and talk about sort of the what would Brian Boitano make part of your life, or this life we're talking about with nationals, about doing cross promotion with food and drink. And what really drew you into that, or how did that sort of all come to fruition for you? It seems like it happened somewhat organically.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, the way that I got into food and mixology is really through entertaining. I mean, we entertain a ton at the house here in San Francisco. people always want to come to San Francisco and visit. So we have a lot of visitors. People stay with us. And so it sort of organically grew from that. And I had an idea. I met one of the producers for a Food Network show through Leanne Miller, who was choreographing my TV specials.
Okay.
And he was a producer that had existing food shows on Food Network. And so I interviewed with him and I said, hey, I pitched him with an idea of combining sort of skating and then like cooking with food and stuff like that. And he said, why don't we just drop the whole skating thing and let's just do food? Cause I think you have the personality that can pull off a whole series and a show of just food. And I said, yeah, most people are asking me to add on the skating. They don't ever ask me to subtract this.
Right. So right. Like, yeah.
Do it. And so we shot a pilot and Food Network liked it and then bought it. So that's how it all really started.
It sounds like for you, it wasn't necessarily during your career. I mean, I guess I don't know what your diet was while you were actually skating, but was food and an interest in nutrition, did that come later in life for you, or was it important to you while you were skating?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I wish I had a better diet when I was skating, lose weight diet. And, you know, when you're young and someone, you know, a judge says you have to lose weight or something and you have 3 weeks until your next competition, you're like, okay, I'm going to just eat vegetables until I lose all the weight. It's amazing. A young body is, you know, sustainable doing long program run-throughs and, you know, numerous, you know, triple jumps and all that stuff, if they're eating celery. I mean, I don't think I could do it at this point, but I eat a diet now more like I should have eaten then, but, you know, I just didn't know. And honestly, when you're young, it's just not a priority to you. You just want to lose the weight.
Sure,
and
right.
Going. So, yeah, but now I eat a diet that would have been really good for training.
I also think, Brian, that, you know, obviously so much has changed since the 80s and 90s when you were competing, but that's almost got to be at the top, just the way that the athletes are educated about and take care of their bodies in that way.
I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's really not only just the eating aspect, but how they're more knowledgeable about their bodies and stretching. And some of them do CrossFit with yoga. And they know a lot more. I mean, we didn't even know, you know, we would stretch, but it wasn't as thorough now. And honestly, I think they need it now because we had, you know, we had compulsory figures that would gradually warm up our bodies. And so by the time we would do an hour of compulsory figures and get on for a freestyle, we were kind of, you know, we were pretty warm already. So these guys just get on the ice, and if they haven't done a proper warm up before, they're going to be pounding their bodies, and you know, and it's going to be tough maintaining and doing repetition of quads and quads and quads, and not having something negative in your body to show for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned that big trip that you're taking to Italy. Now, is that for something else, or it's more of just a personal passion project at this point?
Well, you know what? It's kind of twofold. I renovated the house of my great-great-grandfather, and we spend our vacations there. And I started taking language schools there for about a year, because nobody in my village speaks any English. So I've been learning Italian, and I'm pretty conversational now, so I can actually speak with them and communicate in the village. So every year for the last 4 years, I've been doing an intensive course of Italian.
That's awesome.
I did 1 year in Perugia, 1 year in Venice, 1 year in Chiavari, and this year I'm going to be in Chiavari again and do a month. And it's just fun. It keeps my brain active. It's something fun to learn. And I'm also looking at buying and renovating a new rustic home on the coast near Portofino to open for a cooking school. So that's kind of a passion of mine, is to have a cooking school open for tourists who travel there, that they can go learn how to cook the regional specialties of the Ligurian people.
You're literally putting Eat, Pray, Love into your own life. Oh, I also need you to go to Italy and be our Ice Talk correspondent. We've been trying to track down Carolina Costner now for months. Maybe you can get that interview for us, Brian.
Well, I mean, she's got to be either, because I know, because I've tried to skate in Italy before, and they're like, they only have two rinks. It's either Torino, I think there's one in Milan, maybe one in Rome.
Yes, right.
It is. So all you have to do is plant yourself in two of those rinks, and you'll probably find her.
I did an interview with Carolina Costner a couple years ago, and I took a cab with a cabbie who did not speak any English, this guy from Rome, And we ended up on these dusty roads outside of Rome, and we pulled up to a women's jail. And I said, I don't think this is where Carolina Costner is. But we did find her eventually. She was not at the jail.
Did she speak English? I've never met her.
She does. No, she speaks beautiful English. She was in L.A. for a long time training. She's got great English, yes. And Brian, tell me about the speaking that you're doing or some of the motivational or public speaking that now you're taking on as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people think when I say I'm doing speaking engagements that it's really focused on, skating and my life in, the Olympics and that kind of thing. But I really, I have like four different areas that I speak on, but one of them is like being able to pivot your career in different directions, like into food and
sure,
with the HGTV stuff and through skating. And yeah, obviously that there will be some skating in my speaking engagements, but more importantly, the things that I've learned from skating and the tools that I've learned through competing and going into business and touring for 25 years that I've used to pivot and go into different directions into the food industry and then, do all of that and do the different TV shows and all the other different things that I'm trying to do, like the cooking school and these kind of things. The baseline is that it is from the tools that I learned as a skater that I implement in different parts of my life. And I always say that to young skaters as well, and parents especially. It's like, it's not so important that your kids are champions, because what they're going to learn from pursuing this, especially if they're passionate about it, is how to use what I call life tools to accomplish different things in their life. And if they don't use it in skating or something like that, they'll use it in other places in school or in business later on in their life.
It's funny that you say that, because you were mentioning the TV show and how, your producer friend said, let's just take out the skating portion of it. And you were like, oh, I guess I do have the ability to do this without the skating.
Yeah. And it's not until you go like, okay, so what are my stepping stones to getting a TV show, to doing a cookbook, to doing this, that you're like, you implement the same stepping stones that you did of going from novice men to Olympic champion, and you implement them in a different direction and in a different business. And it's a nice variety, and it's also nice to know that the things that you learn that you spent so much time doing are beneficial in other ways of life.
88, 94 were your Olympic moments, and 84. But once your sort of that part of your career was over with the 94 Olympics, when did you start to realize like, oh, my career is going to entail more than just skate on ice? Was that ever sort of an aha moment, or did that take a while to sink in?
My dream was that even when I was younger, before I even went into the Olympics, I was like, I always hoped that I would become, Olympic gold medalist. But what I really wanted to do is like, go and do shows and tours and TV specials and all that kind of stuff. And man, I was so fortunate that when I won the Olympic gold medal, that it was right at the, right starting the peak. It really started the peak of, those years of figure skating where we had so many options. I mean, we were just doing everything, and I just consider myself so fortunate that I had that life that I could actually do what I like to do, what I was passionate about, and be able to do it for so long and do so many different interesting things. I've been going through my memorabilia recently in the basement, and I'm like looking at all these programs and magazines, and I'm like thinking like, when did I do all this stuff? I've done so much stuff.
You've been busy.
To remember some of it, and
it's awesome.
Just been so, I'm so lucky to have had those years, because when we were doing 90 city tours and playing like domes at Superdome, Alamo Dome, it wasn't lost on me then, but as you get older, you're like, wow, those were pretty darn magical times for figure skating back then.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever thought, Brian, to get into coaching or into choreography whatsoever?
Not really. I mean, I've done choreography for skaters before. Coaching, I like mentoring. I'm not really good at sort of the day-by-day thing, but I think what I like doing is giving sort of little secrets away to people like that will be helpful to an elite skater and might change their whole outlook on a jumping pass or a setup or an arm, just like a little thing that I see that I've learned in my past that helped me. And when you deliver that information to a skater who is ready to hear it, number one, and is, you know, hungry for the knowledge, it makes a huge difference, just a little thing. And I love working with elite skaters who are hungry in that way. So I do that, you know, mentoring and kind of like that. And I like doing that, but I wouldn't want to base full-time on it.
Well, someone who is full-time is your former rival, Mr. Brian Orser. And for the two of you, you guys will be linked, I think, for so long because of what happened in 1988. What was the relationship for you guys personally going into the Battle of the Bryans? Were you friends? Were you enemies? Were you, you know, did you not really care what he was doing? You were just focusing on yourself? Or what was that like?
It's interesting that you said that, because this is the second time in a week that I've talked about this. I did a documentary that's going to be shown during the Olympics next year. It's the anniversary of the Calgary Olympics.
Sure.
And they about that. And, you know, I mean, just like everybody, we were friendly competitors, and we didn't have any, you know, it wasn't like we didn't talk or anything, but, you know, it's kind of hard when you both want the same thing and the person who might be standing in front of you getting that is that other person. It's hard to like be best friends. We were always friendly competitors, and I don't know, we wanted the same thing, so it was kind of hard.
And what about now? Are you friends now?
Yeah, we're friends. I think we're friends now, and yeah, it's interesting. It's so great. I mean, I'm the first, like, I think when Yuna Kim won the Olympics, I was the first one that texted him. I mean, I know he had to be in the press conference, and I'm like, I'm going to text him anyway. And I texted him, and he's like, he wrote me back, and he's like, thank you so much. And so, yeah, I mean, we have great times. You know, we had a lot of great history on tours together, and at one point after the Olympics, when we were on tour afterwards, the two of us went out and we sort of talked about the whole situation that we experienced, because there's really nobody that could understand the experience that each of us went through individually except for each other, because we went through the same thing, but from different directions. And so we sort of, like, talked about it and, you know, and got along with it, and there's not much to say. We're definitely, our spirits are linked in some way. There's a brotherhood happening.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah.
Are there skaters that, you know, obviously from your generation that you keep in touch with now, that you're close with?
Yeah, like, you know, Karen Kadavy, and, you know, from the team. And when I see Peter Oppegard, he was always my roommate, so it's good to see him doing well.
Right.
I do. I'm close. You know, close with Rene Rocha. I'm also, you know, but then other generations, like, because I toured for so many years, that Michael Weiss and I are close, and Michelle Kwan and I are really close. And even though Christy and I were on different tours, I see them more of Christy than anyone else. So, you know, and also to see Paul Wiley, I love that, because we were, the men's team on 88 was a really, really close team. And he, you know, and we lost Christopher Bowman. So,
right,
kind of like right together. So, yeah, there are people that I keep in touch with, and that I fondly remember.
So, Brian, I'm curious about, you know, looking back now at 2013, you're named to that Olympic delegation by President Obama and decided to come out as a gay man. What's that experience now? You know, you've got it in the rearview mirror. Did it feel weighty at the time, and did you feel like you kind of had a responsibility when you were tapped for that delegation?
Yeah, it's interesting. I did feel like I had a responsibility, and that's the reason I did. I mean, people always said, you know, oh man, didn't you feel so relieved that you came out? And I'm like, no, I didn't, because I didn't have anything that I was upset about. Like, everybody in my life knew about me, my family, my friends. It was something that I held as a personal thing, because it was a special side of my life that I share with people who are close to me, not just people that I don't know, or the public, you know? So it's like a personal side of myself. So when, you know, when the White House asked me to be on the delegation, when they vetted me, I said, sure, I'd like to do that. Tell me who else is, let me know who else is on the delegation. And they said, well, we can't really tell you that. And I said, well, can you tell me anything about the delegation? And they said, no, not really. And this was right when Putin's anti-gay propaganda law just came out. And I sort of you know, didn't think about it. But then I woke up and I was doing a show in Courchevel, France, and I woke up and I saw on my Twitter feed President Obama names an openly gay delegation to go represent him in Sochi. And I'm like, what is they, what? And I clicked on it and I read it. And it sort of had everybody's name and then said, and also Brian Boitano is on the delegation. And I'm like, okay, this isn't going to fly because LGBT is not going to like this too much. You know, I really need to, you know, share my personal side of my story with everyone. And I felt really good because I got to speak my piece on all that. I mean, I did probably every political show that has ever existed, from Meet the Press, Hardball,
right,
Anderson Cooper,
right,
and the Today Show. I did every single thing, probably 55 shows. And I really got to, you know, send my message of it. This is an element of who I am, yes. But I think it's, you know, I'm also a skater. I'm an Olympic athlete. I'm a brother. I'm an uncle. I'm a son, all these things. But in this case, and me standing on this delegation and being named to the delegation, it's important for me to stand with everyone else and say there needs to be tolerance and diversity in this world. And I felt the best way to do it was to fully come out.
Where do you see the responsibility or sort of the onus on athletes, if there is any, to come out? I mean, in the last few years, we've seen Adam Rippon's done it, Eric Radford, Timothy LeDuc did it right on Ice Talk. You know, I think for a long time, obviously, things have changed a lot in the sporting world. But, you know, is there purpose for an athlete to come out? Or as you're saying, it's only a part of who they are and it shouldn't matter one way or another.
I think I believe in everything that you said. I believe that it's your own personal experience. And if you feel it's something that you need to do because you need to let people know, then I totally support it. If you feel like it's a private thing and you want to keep it private, then that's your thing. Nobody can tell each other when it's time to come out. That being said, I do think that when people do come out, it helps support other younger people to be more brave,
right,
and to be, yep, more okay, and to realize that there's really nothing wrong with it, that they have other contemporaries or people who are older than them who are just like them, and they are good people living good lives, having good relationships, and if they can be used as role models for that, then that's a great thing.
And I would assume, Brian, that you got a lot of those messages after you decided to come out.
I got I didn't even read anything negative, like on, you know, Twitter, not, like no trolls at all. It was all complete love. It was literally complete love. And I was worried how my contemporaries, I had never even spoken to the people that I toured with about,
right,
who,
right,
I was. None of those. I was kind of worried mostly about who, you know, the guys that I toured with. And when I came up in national figure skating, there weren't any, at least, you know, gay men that I knew in, you know, those last two groups of warm-up. I mean, it was like they were all, so I always kept it to myself because I thought, you know, there's, you know, these guys are straight, and I'm, you know, worried about how they'll, you know, treat me if they ever knew. So that was one of the reasons that I, you know, kept it so quiet when I was younger. And, you know, I would hate for any, I don't think that kids would go through that these days. I'm hoping that they wouldn't. But that was a worry for me.
Well, and I think it's stories like yours that encourage them that there is someone, you know, even if it's not their final two warm-up groups, that there's a warm-up group out there that's going to have someone just like them. So I think a lot of people applaud you for that, certainly.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Brian, one thing we've seen a lot recently in skating is more and more jumping with people having their arms over their heads. And that's something, obviously, that you that you pioneered. Yeah. I mean, is that something when you see it happen, you're like, gosh, that's my trademark on the sport? Or is it, you know, obviously Adam Rippon changed his up a little bit, but it seems like it's something that obviously came from you and that would be another lasting, one of your many lasting legacies.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's fun to see it because I was watching the coverage one time and when Tara and Johnny were going like, oh, when he chose to do a Tano variation on the triple lutz. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool. I love that. It's sort of fun. I mean, I think ultimately in my heart, I was probably a new judging system type of skater. I was always trying, and that's why I did the arm over my head, is because I wanted extra points. I don't think I ever really got extra points for it. But that's originally why I did it. So it's kind of funny that it's commonplace now.
Yeah, and doing trying quads at least in the 80s too. Wow.
Yeah, that was certainly something that not too many people were doing. And, you know, I think that if there were more guys doing quads, that we would have been doing them consistently in competition at that point. But there were only, two or three of us actually actively trying them in competition. I think maybe three of us actively trying them in competition at that point. So I always did it, and I tried it in competition because I thought it was something I might need in the future. And I wanted to start getting it, you know, in competition and trying to get it consistent earlier than everyone else. So it showed in 88 that I didn't need it. So, you know, but that's why I was originally doing quads back in that day.
Well, Brian, lastly, we just named on IceNetwork.com, we named the comeback skater as the person of the year. So you had Virtue and Moyer, you had Carolina Costner, Nathan Chen, Alexa, and Chris Kinnearum. A lot of comeback stories in skating this year, which was really a pleasure to watch, but it harkens back a little bit to the comeback that you made in 1994. And obviously there were some off-ice challenges for that to happen, but what do you remember being the hardest about coming back just, you know, physically and emotionally to that, you know, national and then Olympic stage?
You know, the hardest thing for me was that I got injured the summer before I went back in, and I already had started the ball rolling. I actually got injured doing a triple toe loop, triple loop combination because I wanted that really badly to be in my repertoire, triple toe, triple loop. And I remember where I was. I was in Portland, Maine, and I tore, like, you know, my patellar tendon on my knee. And so that really dictated how much I wasn't able to do for the months and months leading up to the Olympics. So it was all about that injury for me, and I couldn't do repetitions of jumps. I literally had to do, you know, programs like do a warm up and then do a program and then not do a lot of repetition afterwards. So that was the hard part. As far as being prepared, I felt like, you know, I felt like the reason that I lobbied the International Olympic Committee to go back in, because I thought, you know, I'm doing long programs on tour every year. I mean, I'm doing, you know, 7 triples in a show, and I'm doing, you know, 35 tour performances, and I'm doing them cold turkey. And, you know, I felt like I deserve to at least be let in the competition to compete against people. So that being said, I didn't have a problem with that, and I didn't have a problem with competing. It was nice to go back and challenge myself. The big problem that I had was the pain and getting over the injury.
Yeah, I mean, just the toll that the body would take, especially for you being 6 years older, I would assume that's where you really felt it. Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like everything from how I focused on pressure to my concentration level to everything, you know, was intact. And I actually felt even more in control because, like I said, on tours I had been doing, you know, full out, you know, every triple in programs in front of audiences. So I felt like I had a lot of that under my belt. So that was a good experience. I mean, that whole Olympics was weird anyway, because it was the whole Tonya Nancy thing. It sort of, you know, created this, what I called like sort of a dark cloud over the whole thing.
Right, right. Well, Brian Boitano, we thank you very much. And I just had the idea, we got to do an ice talk at Nationals that may involve food and drinks as well. How's that?
Why don't we mix cocktails while we're doing ice talk?
That's perfect.
We can teach them how to do it too. How about that?
I love that. I think the skating fans will like that too. Well, Brian, we look forward to that, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nick.
Hey guys, this is Meryl Davis, and you are listening to Ice Talk.
Well, it's my pleasure to welcome in Meryl Davis. Meryl, welcome back to Ice Talk.
Thank you so much. Yeah, last time it was with Charlie, so I feel like it's only half of me this time around.
Well, we invited Charlie. I think he did a live show with Jackie Wong at World. So this time we only felt like it was fair having you back sans Charlie.
Yes, got to even that a little bit for sure.
So I saw you earlier this month at the Figure Skating in Harlem event, and I want to get to that in just a minute, but you were telling me you've been hard at work at school working on an anthropology degree.
That's right.
How's that going?
It's It's going well, but it's been such a long, sort of arduous process. I started university in 2006, in the fall of 2006.
Okay, you're just on the 12-year plan. That's
fine.
Oh
my gosh, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, because when I first started, I was joking with my parents, like, oh, ha, ha, you know, it'll probably take me 10 years to graduate, and thinking, like, oh, maybe it'll take me, like, 6.
Right.
But you're right, probably 12 to 13 years is a fair estimate.
Yeah, I mean, are you able to even forecast when you'll be finished?
You know, I have a very reasonable, very doable amount of credits left. So to say I'll graduate within the next, like, year and a half, I think is very realistic.
Okay, you're putting it out there.
Yes, I may have been saying that for the last, like, 3 years, but now I think it's actually true.
And, Meryl, why anthropology? What sort of drew you to that?
You know, it's funny, like, so many athletes, I think my academic career, my career beyond sport always seems so far off. But I always had a fascination with National Geographic and specifically the anthropological articles. And so just having a fascination with that field, when I was entering college, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to major in. And my dad said, you know, just focus on whatever it is you enjoy most and you're most interested in, and you know, it'll end up working itself out. So what is it now, like 11, 12 years later?
Yeah.
I'm still going with that, but I'm still completely fascinated by it. So I think it was a good choice.
And Meryl, is there an idea of a career that follows, or you're just mostly, you know, finishing the degree and it's your passion and then you'll figure that out after?
Yeah, definitely the latter. I think that... I think, like so many millennials, I don't know that I necessarily see myself having a job that's super easy to describe. I would love to dabble. I would love to be sort of entrepreneurial. So I think, you know, what do you want to do in the future is definitely as confusing to me as it is to so many people of my generation. So
yeah,
the right answer is probably I have no idea what I'm doing with the rest of my life.
Well, join the club. I'm right
yes.
there with you.
Yes.
And you also were telling me when I saw you at the figure skating in Harlem event, you've got a new dog.
I do. Her name is Bilbo Baggins, like the Hobbit.
But full name Bilbo Tootie Rose Baggins?
Right, yes. Bilbo Tootie Rose Baggins. We named her before we got her. And now that we have her, I don't think the name could suit her more perfectly. She loves digging. She loves exploring. And I'm so in love with her. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And what kind of dog is she, Meryl?
She's a miniature sheepadoodle, so she's half Old English sheepdog and half miniature poodle.
And is she, I mean, she's tiny. I've seen pictures of her on your social media, but is she going to grow to be a big dog?
You know, I think with those mixes, it's always hard to tell because you never really know how much of one breed you're getting versus the other, like what the percentage is. But right now she's about 12 weeks. She's about 12 pounds. So I'm sort of estimating she'll be around 40-ish pounds. It's like a good 15 pounds bigger than we thought she was going to be. But
oh, really?
That's okay. Yeah, but just more to love.
And how are you doing as a dog mom so far?
I think it's my best role yet. But in all seriousness, I mean, I have been sort of on the verge of getting a dog since maybe 2013. And researching dog breeds and looking at pictures of puppies, and that really was my focus when I was so stressed out going into the Olympics. I would just like research dog breeds and look at pictures of puppies. And so,
perfect.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, I just turned 30 and I'm so ready to take on that role. And I have to say, I think I'm doing pretty well so far.
Did you just turn 30?
I did.
Okay. Welcome to your 30s. How do you
Thank
feel
you.
So far? It's a good decade, I think.
It is. You know, I feel better than ever. I feel happier, I think, than I've ever been. I feel excited about, you know, to be excited about your past, your present, and your future, I think is something that is really hard when you're a teenager or when you're in your 20s. It's still really hard for me to say that I'm 30 because I feel internally as though I'm about 24. But I feel great. I do feel really good.
Good. I feel the same way. Now, I'm not an Olympic medal winner, but I feel the same way. It just feels like you're settling more and more into yourself and who you are in your 30s, which is a good feeling.
It is a good feeling. It definitely is.
So I mentioned a minute ago, but can you, there's going to be a lot of Ice Talk listeners who know what figure skating in Harlem is and what it does, mm-hmm. but can you just, for those folks who don't, brief us on the work that they do? They're actually in my neighborhood in Harlem, uptown, and this gala that they hold every May is probably the most kind of one night must see, must be at event for figure skating throughout the year.
I agree. Yeah, the event is, it's great because I think so many high-level figure skaters believe in the program because of their hands-on, because of their, you know, real-life experience with how functional it really is. And the idea of the program basically is it's a youth development program that uses figure skating as an educational tool to teach young girls the life skills they need, you know, not just now on the ice, you know, for practicing and training and competition, but also in school, also down the line in jobs and in college and whatever it might be. This program has an on-ice component. It has academic support. It has a really beautiful community vibe. And so it's a program that makes sense. But then when you meet the girls who've been a part of the program for a long time, it sort of kicks it up a notch in terms of, like, I got it before, but now that I've met these amazing girls who are confident and driven and just amazing all-around girls, you really see the positive and lasting impact the program has on them.
Yeah, and these girls are, a lot of them are minority girls. They're from communities mm-hmm. that are underserved, and you're right, they're these powerful girls. I've gotten the opportunity the last couple of years to stay and listen. They do some spoken word. They stand up on stage in this beautiful gala on the Upper East Side, and they sort of ooze this sense of self-assuredness, which we were just talking about being in our 30s. They're in their teens.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the product of the program and what Sharon Cohen, who oversees it and founded figure skating in Harlem. She's really sort of fostered all of that.
That's right. She's incredible. And like you said, it is probably like one of the premier off-ice figure skating events of the year. And like I said, I think a big part of that is just that so many figure skaters understand the beauty that figure skating can bring to your life off the ice as well, like the lessons that it can teach you. And so I think that's why so many of us really flock to be a part of the organization, is because we see, you know, you don't have to be an Olympian, you don't have to be an Olympic champion to learn these lessons via skating. And so, you know, when a 10-year-old girl from Harlem comes up to you and says, hey, I'm so-and-so, and she just, you know, gives you a nice firm handshake, it's the most beautiful thing, because you know that she sees herself being happy and successful and determined in the future. And I mean, I think the program is a really big part of that.
Yeah. Well, this year was the 20th anniversary gala of four figure skating in Harlem. But a couple years ago, you took the stage and announced at least the beginning of expanding that program to a national base. And that announcement has sort of come to fruition now, and it's become figure skating in Detroit. So tell me a little bit about the program. I think you guys just had your third workshop in the recent past, and you're gearing up for a summer camp this summer.
That's right. Yes, we announced 2 years ago at the Figure Skating in Harlem Gala that we would be expanding into Detroit, or that figure skating in Harlem would be expanding into Detroit. To be honest, at that point, I was excited to do what I could, but I had no idea what my role would be and, you know, how it would work. And really, up until that point, my only job with that, bringing it to Detroit, was convincing the organization in Harlem that Detroit would be the right choice as sort of the first outreach city for figure skating in Harlem. And there's such an incredible vibe in Detroit now, and people are so excited to throw their own time and energy and resources into improving the city, improving the lives of especially the young people who live in the city. And so we've really had a lot of success, knock on wood, so far in terms of support from the community. And then, of course, you know, as most of the listeners will know, there's such a wonderful figure skating community here in Detroit as well.
Right,
so we really have the best of both worlds in terms of support. And like you said, we've had three workshops so far. So basically, those have been opportunities for us to introduce the girls and their families to the program, both off the ice and on the ice, with just a one-day program. And then we have a 5-day summer camp coming up in July and August. and then we'll be starting our full-time after-school program in September.
Oh, so this fall it'll go full-time.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so good. So now, for you, what's sort of your day-to-day involvement? You were talking about you weren't quite sure what that role would be. So have you actually been on the ice with these girls?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have been. My role is really evolving, and I think at this point, I'm really just doing whatever it is that's going to be helpful for the program. Sometimes that's being on the ice with the girls. Sometimes that's talking to the parents. Sometimes that's, you know, reaching out to potential donors or companies within Detroit. It's a great team because we're all just super excited to make the program successful, sort of whatever it's going to take. And my official title is founding co-chair of figure skating in Detroit. So I'm just one of a team of amazing people just really devoted to making sure this program is a success.
That's a very official title, founding co-chair.
Yes, it sounds very official. But,
Meryl, what's been the best part of it for you? I mean, what's been sort of, you know, you've known about and I think been a part of the figure skating in Harlem process, but what's mm-hmm. been the best part about this Detroit offshoot?
I think just how excited the girls are to be getting on the ice. A lot of the girls, most of the girls have never had skates on before, have never been on the ice before, and it's just this fun thing that they get to do that they haven't had a chance to do before. And, you know, they're meeting each other and their parents are there, you know, beaming, seeing them stepping onto the ice for the first time. And, you know, the parents are also so grateful that there is this program for girls in Detroit, because we have a number of really wonderful programs for boys in Detroit. But there weren't a lot of all girls programs, which I think is really special. And so seeing sort of the camaraderie and excitement of the girls is just such a beautiful thing. And, it's a little bit off topic, but I will say there was this adorable, maybe like 6 or 7-year-old girl at our last workshop. And
yeah.
Right before we get on the ice, we ask, you know, do you guys, any of the parents, any of the girls have any questions before we get on the ice? And this 7-year-old girl raised her hand and we called on her and she said, what happens? And this 100% serious. She said, well, what happens if your tongue gets stuck to the ice? What do you do? And she just was, it was so earnest. It's the most
awesome,
sweet question. Yeah.
That was a good question. She must have recently had watched A Christmas Story, right?
Yes, that's very true.
Oh, man. I love that. Well, we're about 3 months removed from you and Charlie White announcing that you guys had decided not to pursue going to the Olympics next season. So tell me where you sit with that decision now and sort of your feelings now that you're a little bit removed. Because last time we had you on the show, it was, I think, only days old.
Yes, that's right. I'm excited. I'm so excited moving into the Olympic season to see what everyone comes up with. It's fun watching, especially the ice dance for me. It's fun watching the rest of Team USA. It's exciting for me because I feel like Charlie and I get to do so much on the ice that's fun and challenging and new, but we also get to do a lot of stuff off the ice that is a little scary because it's all new, but exciting as well. And, you know, that being said, I think at the same time, we see maybe so many of the ice dancers, for example, putting together their Latin short dances for next year and getting music ready and sort of focusing on maybe some ballroom moves and stuff like that. And we love it. You know, we love competing. We love practicing. We love the process. And so I think there will always be a part of both of us. And, you know, I can only really speak for myself, but I think both Charlie and myself will always have those moments of like, oh man, I kind of wish I could be doing that right now too. But despite that, I think we both feel really good about it and we're super happy with our decision.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, Meryl, I mean, you don't have to reveal anything right now, but you probably have some projects or some things for you, you know, being an Olympic gold medalist from the last Olympics. I'm guessing there are a few offers out there that you're figuring out. Okay, how does my non-Olympic Olympic season look this year?
Exactly.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to sort of figure out, does that involve going to the games?
Mm-hmm.
Is it something back home? So yeah, it's definitely exciting to have options and be able to sort of weigh all of those things.
Well, one thing you did after the Olympics in 2014 is both you and Charlie went on Dancing with the Stars, and we've seen figure skating kind of come back into the Dancing with the Stars light this past season with Nancy Kerrigan, who I think really hoped and wanted to go a little bit further than she did. But how much did you watch of Nancy, and what were your impressions of her dancing?
I think I got to see two of her episodes.
Okay.
And I was really impressed. I thought she was fantastic. Especially Charlie and I jumped into Dancing with the Stars, like you said, immediately after the Olympics. And so, you know, we couldn't have possibly been in better shape. And watching Nancy, I thought she was so beautiful. I thought she, you know, she just looked like she hadn't missed a beat in terms of performing. And so I thought she did really well.
I think that was kind of the general feel for her. Maybe not people were surprised, but I think they were sort of pleasantly like, wow, you're killing it. And there was a little bit of controversy the way that she went off the show, but that's what happens with those kind
of things.
Oh, I
don't know. Oh, just your general controversy. Yeah, of course. And so much of Dancing with the Stars is the fan base, too. And, like, not only who's connecting with the people on the show, the contestants on the show and their partners, but also who's calling in, who's voting.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So much goes into that. And I think that was a really big thing for Charlie and myself as well, because Charlie, I think, was just so underrated on the show, and he was so incredibly talented, and he was so great on the show. And then, you know, he got voted off, you know, so much so quickly compared to what sort of I was expecting. But I think that's just how the show goes.
Yeah. I remember coming back from Sochi too and just being so tired. I mean, I cannot imagine what you guys went through. What stands out to you most about that? Because you really did go right into it. And
it must have
just been like this total whirlwind for you, Meryl.
To say it was a whirlwind is like, I honestly am not sure how we did it. And I think the last two episodes of Dancing with the Stars, and maybe the last, like, because Charlie and I were actually on the road with Stars on Ice at the same time we were doing Dancing with the Stars. So typically we would be on the road with our partners and obviously each other doing Stars on Ice, like Tuesday through Saturday or Sunday. We would take the red eye to LA maybe Sunday night, arrive at like 3 or 4 o'clock Monday morning, go to sleep for a couple hours, go to the studio, get our hair and makeup done and just perform on the show and then go back on the road for Stars on Ice. And I think the only thing that got us by is that we were both just having so much fun getting to do Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we just won the Olympics. We were performing in Stars on Ice. It's like we were literally living our dream. But that being said, by the end of, you know, Dancing with the Stars and the tour, which ended within 2 days of each other, my body was just like, okay, this is, you've done, that's it. I can't do anything else.
Yeah, seriously. Your body, you needed a nap at that point.
Yeah.
So, Meryl, you're just coming off the road once again, a Stars on Ice tour. Talk to me a little bit about the tour itself. I think you guys finished in Washington State. And the thing I'm curious about for you is, you know, I think you and Charlie had been talking about what you were going to do for your competitive career for a while. But did this tour in any way feel different, or was the experience with Charlie different knowing that you weren't actually going to be competing next year for Olympic spots?
I think so. That's a really good question. We sort of had been toying with the idea of whether or not to return to competition for so long that really making that decision not to return to competition, I think for sure has an impact on the way we approach professional skating and skating in shows, because, you know, now we know that's what we're doing right now. You know, this is what we're focusing on. And I think for so long, it really was on the back of our minds, like, okay, are we or are we not going to be returning to competition? Or, like, at what point do we need to return to training if this is the decision we decide to make? So it's fun, and I think being able to really sort of step through that door of, okay, we're professional figure skaters now, it's fun. And I think it will also really force us to continue to challenge ourselves more and more creatively now that we really don't have that restriction of competitive rules and things like that. So it's a lot of fun.
And Meryl, in a similar sense, does it feel like a different kind of creative outlet, or do you feel like you can be more free on the ice, or does it change sort of your artistic approach at all?
It does. You know, Charlie and I have been fortunate enough to have so many different opportunities and experiences and influences over the last couple of years that, you know, whether it is Dancing with the Stars or getting a chance to meet people in maybe not even necessarily like the dance field, but, you know, singers and actors and all these people, and just trying to be inspired by them and what they bring to their craft and their art. I think we're excited to continue to sort of integrate that into what we want to do on the ice. And so finishing this Stars and Ice tour and going into the next one, I think we'll really try to continue to branch out more and more as time goes on.
You talked a little bit about summer camp coming up for figure skating in Detroit, but what else is on the docket for you this summer as we turn the page on another season?
Yes, well, Charlie and I are off to Japan pretty much all of June for Love on the Floor, which is one of the professional dancers on Dancing with the Stars, Cheryl Burke, put together some last moves that Charlie and I were a part of. So
right, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, so we're going to be doing that again all of June in Japan. And then I am actually going to school full-time in July and August back home in Michigan. So that is going to be, I think it's the first time I'll be back on campus for school in like 4.5, maybe 5 years. So that's definitely going to be a big change for me too.
Oh, it's literally something you only can do in the 12-year plan.
Yes. Lucky enough to be a part of that 12-year plan.
Now, obviously, you know, the two of you won't be part of the competitive landscape next year, but when you look at the Olympic season, you know, I guess just thoughts from your perspective on what teams are going to have to bring to be a part of not only the conversation to make the top three. I think a couple of weeks ago we were talking on Ice Talk about just how crowded the U.S. field is. And then when you look at the international field, how crowded it is as well. But this really is the season where people have to bring their A games. And in ice dance, it's special because, you know, you guys are sort of assigned different aspects that you have to attack, and so that favors some teams to the others. But I guess, how do you sort of see that now from the outside, and what you expect from people coming into the season?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm really good friends with a lot of the ice dancers competing now, and
sure,
hear what they're doing and the decisions they're making. I'll sort of be like, oh yeah, that sounds good. Yes, that's definitely the right thing. It's just exciting for me to sort of follow their choices and their journeys and sort of see what they're doing and just be excited for them. You know, I remember so well, of course, how stressful it is, but it's also so much fun. You know, it's a different kind of fun. You know, it's not like a going to a party kind of fun. Working hard and seeing the results pay off is just such a joy. And being able to see my friends and former competitors doing that is such a pleasure. And, you know, like you said, the U.S. ice dance field is incredibly deep. And so to see especially those top three teams evaluating where they are now and what they need to be at their best, like you said, in the coming season is amazing. Maddie and Zach are doing the Stars on Ice tour for the first time, which I think is awesome for them. First and foremost, I think to have that performance opportunity and to be able to practice being in front of an audience is amazing for them. And having to perform, you know, in whatever condition, in new cities and traveling all the time and having that consistency, I think is really something that they're going to benefit from going into next year. So I think that's incredible. Maddie and Evan, I know, they really feel, much like Maya and Alex, they feel as though they have a great team behind them. They feel confident in a lot of the choices that they've made, you know, choreographically and who they've worked with. And that was one of the things that Charlie and I really tried to focus on in 2012, 2013 seasons is like, okay, we're doing this now. We want to be the best we can now, but we want to keep these things in mind and sort of set ourselves up well to sort of have everything ready for the Olympic season. And I think those top two ice dance teams, Maya and Alex and Maddie and Evan, have really been thinking about that for a couple seasons already. And so going into the Olympic season, they don't need to like try a brand new choreographer they've never worked with before, and they don't need to completely start fresh. And I think that is a really, really good thing for them.
I do not want to harp on this at all, but we saw a couple of mistakes from Maddie and Evan at Grand Prix Final and then at Worlds, and they were flukes. I mean, I don't think it's fair to characterize them as anything other than that, but how much does that play on them for this coming season? And do you think about it, or do you just kind of push it out of the way and continue on as though you felt like you put out the strong performances you wanted to, the, you know, 99.5% of the rest of the time?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that making those mistakes and addressing it is the best case scenario. You know, I think when you do make the mistake, that's the best place to learn. And so I think if you're moving past it as if everything had gone well, I think you're really missing an opportunity to improve and just become stronger. And
okay, yeah.
I really think that's Maddie and Evan's philosophy is like, you know, things go great, awesome. If things don't go great, let's really face it head on and learn and grow from that. And I think that just based on my conversations with them, I know they're doing that. And that's what makes a strong competitor is learning from your mistakes and figuring out how to not make them again.
Yeah, seriously. Well, yeah. I won't ask you right now, but maybe next time we have you on Ice Talk, I'll ask you to make some predictions.
That sounds great, for sure.
Well, we asked folks on social media to weigh in with some questions using hashtag Ice Talk, and we, of course, got many for Meryl Davis. Laura Ward is asking, I think at one point maybe you were working on a children's book or talking about it. Is that still happening?
Charlie and I would love to make that happen. We sort of had been in talks with a particular company, and somewhere along the line, we sort of ended up not being on the same page with what we wanted. And so we're hoping that it's still happening, but it's on hold for now.
Got it. Okay. Stay tuned, Laura.
Stay tuned, yeah.
Jen is wondering if you would ever consider being on the All-Star season of Dancing with the Stars. I don't even know. Is that a thing? All-Star Dancing with the Stars?
They've done it before.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I would. I don't know. I mean, I've been asked that question a few times, and I feel like I always sort of have to pause and take a step because I had the most beautiful experience. I really loved it. And so I think probably I would. It's just such a wonderful group of people. It's a wonderful opportunity to learn something new and just have a whole wonderful team of people behind you. So, yeah, I think probably I would.
I think it's interesting you say that way too, because you had such a great experience, and in a lot of ways you might just want to leave it there and have that be it, but then you probably want to go back and not recreate it, but you know, feel like you're part of that community again. That's kind of a tough thing in life for anyone to decide, you know, do you revisit that thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the cause for the pause and the answer, just because, like you said, it went the way it was supposed to, and I had just the most wonderful time. And so sometimes I feel like it's better to just close that book and open a new one. So it would definitely require some thought.
Got it. All right. Jen is going to have to stay tuned on that front, too.
Yeah. non-concrete answers here.
That's A-okay on Ice Talk. Amy Sieber is wondering, the naughtiest thing that Bilbo has done so far. Bilbo, is that how you say it?
Bilbo. Yeah. the naughtiest thing she's done so far. I mean, she's honestly so good. She potty trained herself within like 2 days.
Wow.
She was like, oh, I'm just going to pee. I like peeing outside. She does a lot of puppy biting. And so that's one of the things that my boyfriend and I are really focusing on, is trying to steer her in the direction of like chew toys and not calf muscles. But she's only 12 weeks old, and so it's easy to remember that she just doesn't know. Like, she doesn't understand that your hand stops here and the toy starts there. So
right, right.
I think that's probably been the hardest thing so far.
Got it. All right, I might mess this username up, but at Toodle to the Pip, did I get that right? She's asking, and we kind of talked about this earlier, but what has impacted you the most personally on working with figure skating in Detroit?
It feels like such a team in working on figure skating in Detroit. And that's, you know, Sharon from Figure Skating in Harlem, our Detroit-based team, quite a few wonderful people. But also in working with the parents of these girls, it feels like we've already formed this community, this really cohesive community of people who just have the best interest of these girls at heart. And it's been such a wonderful feeling. You know, we're all coming to the table with different experiences and different lessons and philosophies that we've learned in life. But I feel like it's been very natural for all of us to come together and sort of just see the end goal in mind and work together to make that happen. So just a really heartwarming sort of feeling being in Detroit. You know, I'm from Metro Detroit, and just all of us coming together to make a positive difference is it just makes me smile.
Yeah, really no, I think it makes a lot of people smile. It's very cool. Well, Meryl Davis, we're going to close the show with a segment I'm calling Meryl Davis's Must Do's. These are things that Meryl must do in life. MDs, MDs.
I love it.
Okay. What's your must-do breakfast item?
My must-do breakfast item? I love, like, an egg scramble. That's sort of my go-to breakfast.
Yes. Yeah. And does it involve some vegetables, I think?
Yes. We talked about this recently. It involves asparagus, cherry tomatoes, brie cheese, and avocado.
And what's your secret ingredient that I was blown away by?
Is it the Cholula hot sauce?
Well, it was. Well, now it is. It was the coke. What do you use? Coconut oil?
Coconut oil. Yeah, I cook with coconut oil instead of olive oil.
I just go old-fashioned butter, Meryl. Just slap some butter on the pan. That's good for me.
If you come over, I would be willing to cook it with butter.
Okay, deal.
Yeah.
All right, Meryl's must-do workout song right now. What are you jamming to?
Issues. I love the song Issues right now. I can't remember the name of the artist.
I think that's Julia Michaels. I surprisingly know that song.
I have this like really weird obsessive OCD with music where I'll listen to songs on repeat for like a month and then I never want to hear it again. So right now that song is on repeat just constantly. So that's my song.
Got it. Love it. What is your must-do, like when you're studying? What's your must-do setup? Does it have to be quiet? Does it need to be loud? Do you have to have music? How do you study best?
Yeah, I usually, very quiet usually. I'm really easily distracted. And so I sort of have to set like a limit for myself. Like say, okay, I'm going to sit here for 3 hours. I cannot move. I cannot go to the refrigerator. I cannot clean the floor. I cannot like go pillow shopping, you know, like I just, yeah, quiet. Usually just, I like studying in bed, actually. I know that's probably not the most efficient place to study, but I like studying in bed.
Got it. These are Meryl's must-dos, so you can answer however you want. What's your must-do dog activity right now? What are you guys doing?
We play a lot of fetch. She took to fetch very naturally, and so that's sort of like I think we play fetch like a solid 3 hours a day at this point.
What's your must-do next vacation spot?
Oh, I went to Greece and Italy in October, and I really was shocked how in love with Greece I was. So I would really love to explore. I went to Santorini, and so I'd love to explore some of the other Greek islands.
Santorini looks beautiful.
Oh, it was amazing. It was a dream.
What's your must-do vegging out activity? How do you sort of unwind the best?
Well, now playing with the puppy outside is my favorite, but I love just social eating. Like, I love going to a new restaurant and trying new foods with my friends and my family, and I think that's probably one of my favorite activities is, like, going out to eat with my friends and family.
What's your must-do way to keep in touch with people on the road? How are you making sure you're checking in on the dog and the boyfriend and the parents and everyone?
Yeah, FaceTime. I love FaceTime. I think that's changed. Over the course of the last couple of years, I've done a little less texting and a little bit more FaceTime.
Oh, that's great. Via technology, but a little more human interaction than just typing words on a screen.
Exactly, yes.
Awesome. Well, Meryl, thank you so much for chatting with us. Appreciate it, and really appreciate you talking about and sharing with us the story on. And if you guys want to learn more about figure skating in Detroit, just Google it, and there's a great website out there. And I'm excited to hear that the program's full time this fall.
Yeah, figureskatingindetroit.org is our website.
There it is.
We have social media as well. So if you don't want to go to the website, you can just follow along on our social media accounts as well.
Awesome. Figureskatingindetroit.org.
Yes.
As easy
Thank
as
you.
It comes. Thanks,
Thank
Meryl.
Thank you, Nick. Nice
All
talking
right.
with you.
Talk to you soon.
Well, I owe a big thanks, a golden thanks, I guess I should say, to Brian Boitano and Meryl Davis for joining us on episode 33 of Ice Talk. You guys know the drill. We want to hear from you on social media. Use hashtag Ice Talk. Tweet at me, Nick McCarville, or at Ice Network. You can find us on icenetwork.com. Just go to the fans page or head to iTunes and search for Ice Talk. Again, we're on our summer schedule. We'll be putting out episodes about every other week. And of course, I always want to thank my producer, Kate Sullivan, and our IceNetwork.com editor, Mickey Brown, for making this show what it is. We appreciate all of you guys listening. Thanks for taking us for a spin, and we'll talk to you again soon.